It's great to have a chance to speak with Bishop the Overseer. Thanks so much for joining The Antidote.
Appreciate your time. You know, just reflecting today. Today is the third year anniversary of the passing of my mother. So just taking a day here to reflect and, you know, try to gather my thoughts and my feelings. A lot of the emotions and experience that I've had with my mother over the years are embodied in the album, Nation of Immigrant. I appreciate you all giving me the opportunity to speak on the platform. See, like a lot of folks don't like to take that risk, I guess specifically here in the U.S., about airing anything about Nation of Immigrants. I don't think it has anything with the musicality of the tracks. I just think it's the messaging that's embedded in here. We're talking about a social movement. And this album is a history book, and it will outlast my existence.
All of this is going to come up during our talk, but first things first, you got to help me out a bit. Now, do I just call you Bishop or your actual name, Seth?
You can call me Bishop. I think that's what the folks know me as in my artist pseudonymous identity.
I found out that you trademarked your performer name, Bishop the Overseer. Now, I'd never heard of that. Is that something common for artists to do?
It's not a common thing. I guess in my individual capacity as a person, I'm a law school graduate, graduated in a specialty of intellectual property, which consists of patents, trademarks, and copyrights. I think my interest in the law, and specifically as it relates to intellectual property, stems from starting out as a solo artist. My mother and I kind of had to navigate different landmines of folks that wanted to sign me on early on as a recording and performer, to the extent where managers, when I'm in my 15, 16-year-old space, 17-year-old space, wanted me to sign on as a managed act and wanted me to have a life insurance policy where it named them the beneficiary in order to get, you know, representation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mother never allowed me to sign on to those type of agreements with folks. So I've been very careful about not only my own personal safety and navigating the business landscape, but my branding as it relates to that. So I started out having to copyright my own music. And that's how I kind of built like the knowledge of the process of how to get into the copywriting aspect of it. And then just knowing the historical history of how folks have been duped for their talents, their brands, their ideas by not properly having them protected. It's just good practice to specifically intellectual property at all costs.
I hear you. You mentioned about some of your earlier days. You got to tell me, what was it like putting out your debut EP, Brick City's Finest?
You know, in those days, I guess I might be dating myself a little bit. In a pre-2001 space, you didn't have access to a whole lot of instrumentals. You know, the music really starts with the instrumentation and finding producers that can help paint a canvas of imagery and musicality to bring your thoughts to life. If your instrumentals don't sound good, I don't know that people give you the opportunity to be heard. So it was always a challenge finding folks that, you know, made beats that were properly themed, sequence, or could paint a cinematography background on what I was trying to convey in a particular song. So that was one journey. The other journey was, you know, finding places to record music. This is something that my mother endorsed and she helped me. She was my financier coming out the gate. She felt that doing stuff in the music space was a good thing. It was an excellent way to express artistic expression. It was something that had the ability to become lucrative one day. And it kept me out of trouble. So amongst other things. So that's kind of a bit of the journey of where do I find my beats? Where can I record them? And then try to figure out how to write music and write it in a way that can be not only understood, but get on the air.
Now, that debut came out 2 decades ago, and the sound of Bishop the Overseer has certainly changed quite a bit. But was that a natural progression?
I think that comes with time, you know, history, life experiences, being able to travel, you know, eventually, you know, meeting my now spouse, traveling internationally and the like. All of those things are like building blocks, I would say, because to me, you could kind of feel in any artistic expression, but specifically in songwriting, you can tell whether people have had experiences or not, or how condensed their experiences are. And it really goes to folks that know how to write and perform it. It's different when folks are just performers and they're just performing something someone wrote for them. But mm-hmm. when you're the writer and performer, I think your writing shows your evolution in your human space as a person and where you've been, some of the experiences you've had, some of the research that you conducted, how well read you are. So it kind of evolves from there. So I think that's why the sound has evolved from the Brit City's Finest space, because I didn't have as many life experiences.
I understand that. Well, tonight you and I are here to talk about your latest, Nation of Immigrants. That's the most powerful album I've heard in years. But you know, the funny thing is that it's hard to label it because it's about politics, history, and social problems, like what you brought in on the title track, 44 Steps Forward, 45 Steps Back. We are a nation of immigrants, so why are you sending us back? You're falsifying the narrative, using alternative facts. The courts relaxed, stop and frisk, but you want to bring it back. Who cares about a wall? We need our healthcare intact. Now, and I mean, that's just a sample. By the end of the song, I really thought that your head was going to explode.
That is true. You know, you have to kind of understand the lens in which that is coming through on a kaleidoscope. So I come from, you know, a mother that was born in the Jim Crow era. And right. you're getting the evidence of the social movement directly from the source, in a sense. And then, again, my grandparents being born at the beginning of the 1900s, their parents and foreparents were slaves. And then you mix that with the ideologies of my father, who's not born here in the United States. He's born in Nigeria. Mm. And being a person that came here as a foreign exchange student, and then meeting an undergraduate, you're getting a very good mix of two different worlds, in a sense, because there's no direct slavery attachment on my father's lineage, because he's indigenously from Africa, people that did not come through the transatlantic slave trade. But then you have my mother's background of folks that basically did come through the slave trade and make it to the Americas to be enslaved. So when you take those two worlds and you come up with those ideologies, and you know, that's just a melting pot of information and ideology and philosophy that you get by the fireside before you even enroll in preschool, you understand? Take that information and cultivate it into a knowledge process where you develop a certain level of critical thinking.
Absolutely. I probably should explain to you that I don't usually get into talking politics. But with Nation of Immigrants, we really have to, because my country, Canada, is built with immigrants coming to our land. But, you know, with your new president, it seems like you're not going 45 steps back. It's more like 100 steps back.
It feels like it. You know, I know it's been some years in the making. You know, I started writing this album in the 2017 space. So it's been, you know, some time to kind of build on a knowledge base. But you have to understand that it was actually more scary and more, for me at least, that he became president in the first place. You know, I was floored that anyone took him serious enough to vote for him for the office of the presidency. and the stuff that happened as a result of his presidency, it kind of feels like he's almost been insulated from a lot of his transgressions and a lot of stuff that he's done. But it only speaks to the indifference that they have for what I would call the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They still have a vantage point that I wouldn't have. I don't think that I could do or even be nearly accused of those things that he's been found liable for and still have my freedom. So I think the album speaks to that point. And the beautiful thing is that it still resonates, even though we've been writing it over time. It speaks to how things don't really change that much. We almost are in a reversal state with administrative orders that he's trying to put in place, trying to reverse a lot of progress that's been made. I didn't vote for him the first time. I didn't vote for him the second time, to be quite frank. I don't know how he got there. To me, you know, Judge Marchand should have not only upheld the conviction, but he should have stayed the incarceration until he left office.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder how much that ties into Battle Cry, Civil Disobedience, when the song says, "This is the battle cry, the sound of civil disobedience. It don't matter if you agree with it. Even if I fail, I tried leaving it." Is this album actually your personal battle cry?
I think it's the battle cry of many. When I hear the current president trying to put in an executive order to kill birthright citizenship, it feels like a disregard that this country was taken from the Native Americans. There's nobody here in the U.S. that's indigenous to the U.S. except the Native Americans. They were the original people here. So the fact that you are saying that no one should have a birthright citizenship right to be here, that includes the person who wrote them, right? Because his lineage doesn't put him here. His lineage puts him somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it's a disregard, or almost a disrespect, for Native Americans, first and foremost. It not only speaks to the Native American plight, it speaks to the plight of any person that immigrated anywhere, for that matter. If you go into a deeper context of it, you know, we, our own people, were contributory in us being sold into slavery. It wasn't something that came by divine intervention or Europeans being able to access Africa without, I guess, access in a sense. So when they're brokering deals for folks, from my research, I found that they were dealing with folks that controlled that territory.
It was
tribal kings or persons that were warlords, the movers and shakers of the African nation. And I say battle cry, it's a battle cry across many different spectrums. Whether we're talking about the Haitian Revolution, or whether we're January 6th, even though that's not my plight to, you know, overthrow the U.S. government. The thing is, I reference that to say that society outnumbers status quo. When people get to a boiling point and they get fed up for not being able to have access to just equal ground, whether it be education, and not just for the sake of being able to get a high school education and go to college. You know, I talk about the battle cry from a space of economics and or weaponizing the U.S. Constitution and the amendments, because they amended the Constitution, the 13th Amendment, after the Civil War to say that no person shall be enslaved. But the sentence that allows the prison complex to operate here in the U.S. is but for imprisonment. So now people can be entrapped through the law enforcement process, because if you become a person that becomes incarcerated, that's the next best thing to slavery outside of cheap migrant labor that you don't want to change the immigration laws.
Now, I want to switch topics here totally. I was flipping through your Facebook and I found a post that you put in a few years ago. It included a verse from Luke. "But I say unto you which hear, love your enemies, do good to them which hate you, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which despitefully use you. Now, you use that to eulogize the passing of Nipsey Hussle, but we do all know that verse. So on a personal level, is that a difficult verse for you to follow?
I think on many levels, don't have any other choice. You know, I'm not a person that lives in a vigilante space where you go out and get your own vigilante justice. I can't say that that's been afforded to some of us that have been, you know, hung and strung up and burned alive. But I do have to, you know, yield to societal norms if I want to be a part of society. That's not to say that I don't recognize the differences and the impediments that face us. But also want to be clear that folks that are your opposition or your enemies, or they're not always who you think they are, right? So it's not all one-sided. But for example, I don't consider white people my enemy. I don't live in that headspace. In fact, I've had a lot more white folks to be allies in some cases than my own kind. And then the reverse is true. I probably found more people that look like me that have created more barriers to my success than the other side. So I waive interactions with folks on a case-by-case basis. If you show me respect, I show you respect. That's really how it goes until you prove different. If you have trust in me, I'll trust you. The same is true for a person with a political difference. I have a neighbor that lives a couple doors down from me that has a Trump insignia in his garage. Boy, he treats me with respect when he sees me. He communicates with me with respect. I communicate with respect with him. And, you know, his political beliefs are his, but he doesn't let that interfere with the humanity of the human-to-human interaction. So say that to say this, if I saw a person that I consider to be in opposition to my thought, if I saw them being harassed or beat up in the street, I would intervene no different than I would intervene if someone that looked like me would be lynched, because both are incorrect. I do live in a space that, you know, human beings should have respect for one another. Whether you're a Buddhist, whether you're a Protestant, whether you're a Catholic, whether you're a Muslim, whatever your religious belief is, however you believe yourself to be, everyone should have respect for what folks are, regardless of whether they agree with it, and not treat folks with such a disdain.
That respect aspect comes into another of the songs found on your album. You know, anytime I hear the word breathe, I instantly think of the murder of George Floyd. But there's so much happening in the song Breathe. I mean, it speaks of slavery, abortion, war, colonialism, guns. Why did you want to cover so much ground in a single song?
I guess the instrumental is what created the song concept. The chorus section in Breathe started as a bridge from a track on the album called Dear Past.
Right.
So Dear Past is first in time because my son, Junior, was a four-year-old when he helped me do the bridge in Dear Past. But then when I found the instrumental, and the instrumental actually was entitled Breathe, the producer that made the instrumental, Tone Jones, had entitled that instrumental Breathe. I think it immediately, I thought about that bridge section from Dear Past. It's very rare that you'll get a connection like that. It was almost like the perfect pathway from Dear Past to using that bridge to now that's the chorus for the song Breathe. And Breathe comes from many different aspects. What I think about myself as an asthmatic, breathing is very essential. And you can't have any formal impediments to breathing. But as you say, you know, I think about, you know, people like George Floyd, think about people like Emmett Till, think about folks like Malcolm X and Mega Evers, think about Trayvon Martin, and specifically Eric Garner out of New York. That's really where it really exudes, because we all saw him get choked out by the police in a chokehold And that's all he could say is, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. So I said, how could I talk about Eric Garner experience, even though I don't know him, even though I wasn't there, I can empathize and show sympathy and understand what was happening at that time. He just wanted to breathe. But there are many people that can't breathe. You know, that person that can't breathe could be a child that's told to go to a safe zone in a war zone. And then after being told to go to that safe zone, they shoot a missile through the safe zone to kill a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be, you know, a person being marched to the death camps in Auschwitz and being burned alive. It could be the person's on the, I guess what I would call the death march at Senegal at the point of no return when they were loaded onto ships to be transported through the transatlantic slave trade. It could be a variety of different things that contribute to a person just wanting to breathe. You understand? So I tried to encapsulate the global breathing effort within two verses on breathe.
There's been something I've been trying to figure out is how Bishop the Overseer creates. What do you want to see on top? Is it the entertainment value or is it actually the message you're creating?
I think it's probably more message-based for me in the research process. You know, I don't have an expectation that folks will take what I say on face value. But, you know, what I do want them to take away is the thought of, you know, I hear what he's saying and let me go, you know, research that to find out for myself if it's true or not and to what extent it is or it isn't. You know, my stuff that I specifically put into this album, you know, a lot of these things predate my existence on Earth. So you have to rely on your ability to do research and to bring snapshots of events to life through the oratory delivery.
Lord Knows is a song that you and I should talk about. It's like many of your songs. It speaks about faith, but it's not always in a positive light. You know, with lines like closing the Bible on false idols, they bequeathing a myth, or the slave preacher's facetious, but the believer blessed. And then there's weaponizing religion to gain superior wealth. Now, I know I'm taking those out of context, but can faith be misused?
I think faith is the pinnacle of misuse. I learned now in my PhD studies, I've ran across the doctrine of discovery. And I never heard of that until researching for my dissertation topic.
Oh, yeah. And it was horrid.
Yeah. So essentially, to give some context to folks that are not familiar with the doctrine of discovery, it's something where I'll say the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from a European perspective, and this is unilateral. This is not like someone, you know, we're folks are agreeing to this on, you know, you have consent, if you will, but it's a unilateral thought of if I find a new world or new territory or new people that I encounter and they are not of the same religious belief and faith as I am, if I'm a Christian or if I'm a Catholic and they are not of that, and they don't speak English like I speak, they have their own native tongue, they have their own cultural beliefs, their things don't matter. And I have the unilateral right to take not only the land and property that these folks have, but I can make them succumb to my belief through the doctrine of discovery. And is really founded in religion, in a sense, because most institutions of colonialism, even to this day, are founded through churches, and they're founded through the schooling system, the education system. Mm-hmm. This is why folks put so much emphasis on book bans and not being able to teach certain history. I mean, not even when they're cut out of the womb, it's like children, in my point of view, can hear what's going on the outside while they're in the womb. So it's the sooner you can teach that fetus what you want them to know, the sooner you can control the narrative. From education, from, you know, daycare, pre-K through however far they go in school, the message is also reverberated through the church. And religion is weaponized in many ways. I don't want to talk people against, you know, going to church and believing in whoever they believe in. But I've found in my religious journey that going to church has been an experience that is more suppressive than evolutionary. You know, two examples of that is I've seen people, including, you know, my own mother, give to the tithe in church. But folks can't afford to tithe. They may not even have food in their refrigerator. They may not even have nothing to eat when they go home. Their lights may be turned off, but they'll give their last to a tithe offering. Realistically, at that time, it puts you in a more compromised state where you may not eat that night. So stuff like that is not a rational thought of how you would move. Folks can be one way or another easily swayed. So we used to always go to something called watch night. I just became more familiar with during the pandemic as well. And, you know, my mother, you know, would always make us go to watch night. And watch night is something that happens. It's New Year's Eve going into New Year's Day. We would go maybe at 10 p.m. on New Year's Eve, a church service and a prayer into midnight until, you know, we reached New Year's. I never knew what watch night was until recent. And watch night really stems from slavery, where slaves would pray that their families wouldn't be separated because they always did turnovers for New Year's Eve. They would separate families, mothers from fathers, children from parents, whomever the family dynamic was, trade human beings on it. So you would pray that your family wasn't the one that was traded away, that you were able to stay together as a family unit. So that's why you would pray on New Year's Eve to pray that it wouldn't happen on New Year's Day. But we were never taught that in church. I don't want to be so conclusory that I painted with such a broad brushstroke across all churches. So I'm not trying to do that. I'm just really speaking about my experience in the religious space. I just think that churches should do a better job at protecting the people.
Let's flip into something else here. Don't be offended when I say that I don't tend to find much positivity on Nation of Immigrants. I mean, someday hints at it. Unbreakable bond between mother and son in perpetuity. God knew it would be. It's so immaculate. Conception, metamorphic transformation can be challenging. But here's something. Do people need a happy, supportive song, or is getting the truth more important?
I think being honest, because I think I don't know that you can properly heal without some form of truth. Right, I think you're just living in a fallacy without the truth. If you live in such a bubble that you only understand what's going on in the four corners of your neighborhood, you're a person that doesn't have a good understanding about life. Life is much more broader than the four corners of your neighborhood. It's bigger than your Beverly Hills. It's bigger than, you know, any place that you could go to shop in New York City. You know, the world is a very broad place, and people are having experiences, good or bad, all across the world. It's like segregation. There were days that, you know, nothing wasn't popping off, the day of calm. Even if it was calm before the storm, it was still calm. You enjoyed the sunny days. But there are also days where they became very bloody, days that were very confrontational. Days that stuff popped off. So to bring it back to your point, in order to have a positive outlook on things, you need to be realistic about where you sit. So for me, getting the information out there so you're informed, so you can have those conversations about how they make you feel. And then if things can create a healing process.
Now, every track on Nation of Immigrants tells a story. I'm curious as to how your listeners are responding to this release.
I think some folks are closeted about how they feel about it. I think from a mass publicity standpoint, there's certain publications that wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. At least that's what it feels like. Because if you take an album the way you're ascribing it, and you take it to like Rolling Stone magazine, or you take it to Billboard magazine, and you don't even get a response back, that leaves you with some pause. But I just think folks sometimes are fearful for, you know, having these type of conversations. And sometimes, you know, your innermost thoughts about how you think about things, you can't really say how you feel about it because you feel that in your mind you'll be condemned. That's kind of the response on one side I get from, you know, major media. I may have folks up there that, you know, are believing in what's being said in the messaging, because I don't think it has anything to do with the sound of the tracks, the flow and the instrumentation. I think all of those things are pretty much on point. But I think if the messaging was something like if I was saying things that were denigrating to my people, like half-naked women in like music videos, or I was talking about selling drugs, those things would get more spins and more play. But on the fact that I've chose to, you know, say something that was more intellectually stimulating to make people think, you get a lot of pushback on that. People listen to the music, it's like a whole nother experience. People fall in love with the music and what we're saying in the music. I think people enjoy how I put it together.
Well, my thought is that I really do hope it makes a big impact. I got to thank you for coming to The Antidote. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate your time, and thank you for having me on the platform.